2 Samuel chapter 16. King David finds himself in a very difficult situation. His son Absalom has rebelled against him and has very craftily stolen the hearts of the people of the children of Israel away from David and led them in a rebellion against David. And not only that, but has carefully stolen away some of the most gifted and most talented men in the kingdom. One of those men is a man by the name of Ahithophel, who has joined with Absalom in his rebellion against his father. You can look at these two guys, Absalom and Ahithophel, and we're going to see them in just a little bit and wonder, why would they link up together? It doesn't make sense. Ahithophel is one of the most gifted men in the history of the entire nation of Israel. Stay with me. The great counselor that counseled David, probably the greatest politician, pure politician, and I mean that in the best sense of the word, in the history of the nation of Israel. And yet he joins with Absalom in the rebellion against David, against his father. Ahithophel has no respect for Absalom, but they unite together out of the unity of their bitterness against David. Ahithophel was the grandfather of Bathsheba, and he had been waiting for 10 long years from the time that Bathsheba was sinned against and Uriah was killed by David. He was waiting for that call to come from Absalom, some means of expressing his bitterness against David. And sure enough, Absalom makes contact with him, and now he sees this as his chance to get even with David. Bitterness has a tremendous shelf life in our lives. It will either be dealt with as an act of my will in obedience to God and to His Word, or it will live a very, very long time in my life. And it's very, very dangerous. It is very, very interesting how sometimes one bitter person will find themselves connected with another bitter person and do great misdeeds against really the kingdom of God. They think, we must be right. I mean, there's two of us to think this way. And the fact of the matter is, bitter people attract bitter people. And if a bitter person will find themselves very, very quickly surrounded by other bitter people. They're recognized quickly as being such, and they like one another's company. And so this great rebellion has been led against David. David sends back Hushai, his counselor, back into the city of Jerusalem to defeat the council of Ahithophel. He sends back Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, in order that they might tell him what it is that's going on in the rebellion there in Jerusalem. So David has fled out of the city, and as he's making his way out of the city, we pick it up here in chapter 16. And when David was a little past the top of the mountain, there was Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, who met him with a couple of saddled donkeys, and on them were 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, and 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. Very, very timely, Ziba's arrival here with food. The king said to Ziba, "What do you mean to do with these?" And Ziba said, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and the summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who were faint in the wilderness to drink." And then the king said, "Where is your master's son?" And Ziba said to the king, "Indeed, he's staying in Jerusalem, for Mephibosheth has said, 'Today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me.'" And Mephibosheth was the son of Saul, and he thinks, and Ziba is claiming that Mephibosheth is saying that the kingdom's going to be returned to him as the rightful heir of the throne in his mind, because David has been dethroned. "And today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me." And so the king said to Ziba, "Here, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours." And Ziba said, "I humbly bow before you that I may find favor in your sight, my lord, O king." And here is Ziba. He's the kind of guy that is always looking for an opportunity to be upwardly mobile. And they were existing in those days. And they take a very vulnerable time in David's life. And this whole thing is not exactly the way that he's putting it here. Mephibosheth wanted to come out to David. He's been a servant of David's, son of Saul, sitting at David's table. And David had been gracious to him and provided for him. But when he sent for the donkeys for him to be taken out to David, Ziba never came back and got him. And he was lame and he couldn't be picked up, get himself out there. And so Ziba is really slandering now this servant of David, but it's going to be a time before it becomes apparent. And so there are Zibas in this world, and they just look for an opportunity to, every opportunity, no matter how bad it is, to improve their position. They're really without character. Now, when King David came to this place, there was a man of the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there. And he came out cursing continually as he came. So here's David, his 600 men, and his family and all, and they're going over the Mount of Olives, and they're heading out into the wilderness area. And here this descendant of Saul, he comes out swearing and cursing David. And then he threw stones at David and all the servants of King David. And notice he's throwing stones. He keeps a coward's distance. And the Shimei will always do that. He won't get close enough because he knows there's people among David that will take his head off in a second. But David isn't going to allow it to happen. So he's always enough distance where he can throw a rock, and if they turn on him, he can run. And he's a coward here, and he's going to hit David while he's down. And so he comes with all of his false accusations as he cries out and he says to David, when he cursed, come out, verse 7, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you worthless man, you rogue. And then quite a vocabulary he had, though. And the Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you've reigned, and the Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom your son. So now you are caught in your own evil because you're a bloodthirsty man. That's an absolute lie. David never raised his hand against God's anointed. He had plenty of opportunity to kill Saul, and he never did it. This man is completely wrong in his assessment of David, and he's completely wrong in his throwing of stones. But it happens, and it'll happen to you in your service to the Lord. Completely wrong accusations. There'll always be people who will wait until you look like you're down or in a point of weakness, and then they don't have enough chutzpah, they don't have enough nerve to come to you man to man or person to person and say, listen, I don't like this about you. I think that you did this, and allow it to be worked out man to man. They'll wait until you're in a moment of vulnerability, and then they'll come out and they'll curse you, and then they'll throw stones at you. It just happens. That's the kind of a guy that piles on, you know, to people when they're in a great and difficult trial. They don't understand what the trial's about. They don't understand what God is doing even in David's life here. They think they know. They think they've got the hotline to God. And so they're going to bring the accusations in this way. And all of it is a lie. And then Abishai, the son of Zariah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Apparently this dead dog thing was big back then. But it just, again, just saying, this guy's worthless. Again, the only thing more worthless than a live dog is a dead dog. There's nothing you can do with a dead dog. It's absolutely good for nothing. You can't make hamburgers out of it. You can't make soap out of it. There's nothing. You just bury him. So that's what he's saying. He's just a worthless, this worthless person, this dead dog. Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Please, let me go over there and take off his head. There's always going to be an Abishai on hand, too. When you're in that place, you have the Shimei come against you. There's always going to be the Abishai that's going to say, listen, let's go to the quick solution here. Let's just kill him right on the spot and confirm every accusation he's making against you. And then because now you will be a bloodthirsty man. You have to be careful of that. And again, sometimes the people that are closest to us in times of difficulty, it's really hard for them. Because it's hard for us, but the only person that it's harder on in a trial than the person who's in the trial are the people who love us and are watching us in the middle of that trial. They want to come in and sometimes help us, and sometimes their heart goes a little bit further than what, you know, godly principles go, and they decide, okay, we can end this trial quick. We'll just go ahead and kill him. And the king said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? And so let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, 'Curse David.' Who then shall say, 'Why have you done so?'" Listen, leave him alone. Don't be tempting me with a desire to cut his head off. And David said to Abishai and to all of his servants, "See how my son, who came out from my own body, seeks to kill me. How much more may this Benjamite, this descendant of Saul? Let him alone and let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered him. It may be that the Lord will look on my affliction and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day." And so David just looks at the whole scene. His whole world is spinning. The last 24 hours are beyond his belief. If you've ever been in a trial there where you just woke up one day, everything was fine, had your breakfast, some Rice Krispies, a little toast, glass of orange juice, and before the day is over, your whole everything is pulled out from under your feet. And he's really trying to get a line on this thing. He's trying to understand what in the world is happening. He doesn't know what God is doing and what God isn't doing. He doesn't know what man is doing and what man isn't doing. He doesn't understand what's happening. And so what does he do? He does what's very, very wise. He waits. He waits until there's a little more information. There have been times in my life where I have been like David here and I have waited. And then there have been other times where I have been Shimei, and I've left so much blood around me as a result of trying to figure out, or thinking I haven't figured out, what it is that's happened. And I have never regretted waiting longer on the Lord for more information to fully understand the situation. That's what he's saying. He's just going to wait, and he doesn't want to be tempted to move too quickly. And he just has the attitude, and it's a beautiful revelation of David's heart. He's just going to trust the Lord in this. And he's going to wait until the Lord maybe has something to teach him in this, and he wants to learn from it. And so as David and his men went along the road, Shimei went along the hillside. Yeah, you little scamp. Opposite him, and cursed him as he went, threw stones at him and kicked up dust, you know. And now the king and all of the people who were with him became weary, so they refreshed themselves there. Shimei is going to regret what he has done like you cannot believe. He will be a different man the next time we see him. As is so often the case with Shimeis, and when we are Shimei, I tell you, the day comes when you look at what you've done there and you are a different man concerning the person that you dealt with in that way. And meanwhile, Absalom and all of the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel was with him. And so it was when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, that Hushai said to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. And Absalom said to Hushai, "Is this your loyalty to your friend?" Speaking of David, "Why did you not go with your friend?" And Hushai said to Absalom, "No, but whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel choose, his I will be, and with him I will remain. And furthermore, whom should I serve? Should I not serve in the presence of his son? As I have served in your father's presence, so I will be in your presence." And then Absalom said to Ahithophel, "Give counsel as to what we should do." Here's the great picture of Absalom's, and any Absalom that you find yourself uniting with. And Absalom is only good at rebellion. That's all he's good at. And once he has led his rebellion and he has captured the kingdom that he has led the rebellion for, he never knows what to do with it. Never knows what to do with it. And Absalom never has the necessary character within his life to make any use out of the thing that he rebels for. You understand that? And how often there is that case, even within the body of Christ, where there are those rebellions that are led. And then it's not till after the rebellion is through that you then turn to the person who led the rebellion and say, okay, now what are you going to do? And you discover this guy's only good at rebellions. He doesn't have anything within him as it relates to leading God's people or leading anything as it relates to God's plan. And so he doesn't have the slightest idea what to do at this time. Ahithophel said to Absalom, and his counsel is brilliant. He says, go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, the 10 concubines, and all of Israel will hear that you are abhorred by your father, and then the hands of all who are with you will be strong. Go in and lay with the 10 concubines. Because when the men that have aligned themselves with you hear that you have disgraced your father in this way, they'll be confident that you will not reconcile with your father. See, that was always the danger in joining up in a rebellion with another king, was that after the rebellion had been led, the two kings would get together, and then the men who had joined the rebellious leader would then be killed as a result of it for having been so treacherous. And so Absalom is saying, Ahithophel is telling Absalom, go in, make it clear to all of the men that are following you that you will not reconcile with your father. And so they pitched a tent for Absalom on the top of the house, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. And the counsel of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one had inquired at the oracle of God, and so was all the counsel of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. And you have to stop there just for a moment and think about that. The entirety of Ahithophel's life, when he spoke, it was like God was speaking, because God was speaking through him. This man was brilliant. This man was enormously gifted. Gifted in a way that those of us in this room sometimes can only dream about. Tremendous the calling of God on this man's life. And yet it's all going to end up being a waste. But never look at Ahithophel as being some marginal person. And never look at him as have been an unspiritual person. He was greatly spiritual at one time in his life. And if we think of him as being something less than that, then we'll miss the point of his life, which we'll get to in just a few minutes. This man was huge as a man of God at a time in which there were huge types of men of God in the history of the nation of Israel. It was a time of spiritual giants. And moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, now let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David tonight. He continues his counsel. I'll come upon him while he's weary and while he's weak and make him afraid. And all of the people who are with him will flee, and they'll strike only the king. And then I will bring back all of the people to you. When all return except the man whom you seek, then all the people will be at peace. And the saying pleased Absalom and all of the elders of Israel. And his counsel is perfect. His counsel is good. And God is going to describe it as good in just a few verses. Notice that Ahithophel knows that David has left the city with 600 men. He has great respect for David. He said, you give me 12,000 to go get him right now. I'm not going out with 1,000 or 600. I know what he's like. I know what kind of a man he is. I know his character. I know his bravery. I know those things about him. You give me 12,000 tonight, and I'll go ahead and I'll kill him tonight. And that's what Absalom should have done. And that was the most brilliant of all of the military counsel that he's going to get here. But he wants a second opinion. And Absalom said, now call Hushai the Archite, who David had sent back for this very purpose, and let us hear what he says too. And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom spoke to him, saying, Ahithophel has spoken in this manner. Shall we do as he says? If not, speak up. And Hushai knows immediately, if they do what Ahithophel has said, David will be dead before the night's over. And so Hushai said to Absalom, probably buying just a little bit of time here for his plan, and he says, "The counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time. For, said Hushai, you know your father and his men, that they're mighty men, and they're enraged in their minds that you've done this like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field, and your father is a man of war, and he will not camp with the people. And surely by now he's hidden in some pit or in some other place, and it will be when some of them are overthrown at the first, some of your men as they come on them, and whoever hears them will say, there is a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom, and even he who is valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt completely. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant men. Therefore I counsel that all Israel be gathered together to you, Sir Absalom, from Dan to Beersheba, like the sand that is by the sand for multitude, and that you go into battle in person. Yes, who shall I tell me more? Me at the front of this army that is without number as the sand of the sea. Yes, I could see it myself with my mind's eye." And Hushai is playing with this guy's pride like you can't believe. And there really is nothing more easy to manipulate in a man and in a woman, certainly in a man, than his pride. That's what's happening here. And so we will come upon him in some place where he may be found, and we will fall on him as the dew falls on the ground. And of him and all the men who are with him, there shall not be so much left as one. And moreover, if he has withdrawn into a city, then all Israel shall bring ropes to the city and will pull it into the river until there's not one small stone found there. And so Absalom and all of the men of Israel said, "The counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel." Oh, no, it wasn't. But now we found out why. For the Lord had purpose to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, to the intent that the Lord might bring disaster on Absalom. Important lesson here. Ahithophel is bitter against David as the grandfather of Bathsheba. But David had confessed his sin and he had repented. And there is nothing more a man can do with his sin than that. To confess his sin and to turn from his sin, turn back to God and live a godly life, and the fruit coming out of his life as an evidence of that. That's all that David could do. And when a person does that in our lives, God tells us to forgive them. Doesn't mean they were right. Doesn't mean that David was right with Uriah. Doesn't mean that David was right with Bathsheba. But God calls us to forgive people when they have confessed their sin and repented of their sin. And if you won't do that, and if I will not do that, and I continue to try and mete out my own justice upon the person that has sinned against me, then what you force God to do, and what I would force God to do, is then to actively resist me. And he'll do it. And you don't want him to do that. And that's what he does. God loves Ahithophel. And God understands Ahithophel. He understands his bitterness. He understands his anger. He understands his heart. He understands all of those things. But he had called Ahithophel to forgive David, and Ahithophel refused to do it. And so God comes in now, and he resists Ahithophel himself. David was in need of grace. David wasn't proud of what had happened to him in his life there. And I'm convinced that this whole chapter in his life, I mean, it was the most shameful thing that could happen to him. Embarrassed about it, all of those things. There's nothing else he could do but confess his sin and repent of his sin, and that's what he had done. But that wasn't enough for Ahithophel. And if that's not enough for you tonight, You can say, listen, you don't understand. Listen, it can't be worse than Ahithophel. We can try and justify the bitterness, justify those things, but tonight you must understand that bitterness has one end, and at the end of it, Ahithophel's going to be dead, 20,000 men are going to be dead, and Absalom's going to be dead. It's always the end of bitterness. It can never have a different end. And so the warning here to extend grace and leave to the Lord what He alone keeps in His hands as it relates to dealing with people in their confession of sin and repentance. And then Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, thus and so Ahithophel counseled Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus and so I have counseled. And now therefore send quickly and tell David, saying, do not spend this night in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily cross over. Get out of here, lest the king and all of the people who are with him be swallowed up. Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz stayed at En-Rogel, and they dared not be seen coming into the city, so a maidservant would come and tell them, and they would go and tell King David. Nevertheless, a lad saw them and told Absalom, and both of them went away quickly and came to the man's house in Bahurim, who had a well in his court, and they went down into the well. And the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and spread ground grain on it, and the thing was not known. And when Absalom's servants came to the woman's house looking for these spies, they said, where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan? And so the woman said to them, they've gone over the water brook. And when they had searched and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. Now it came to pass after they had departed that they came up out of the well and went and told King David and said to David, arise, cross over the water quickly, for thus has Ahithophel counseled against you. And so David and all of the people who were with him arose and crossed over the Jordan. And by morning light, not one of them was left who had not gone over the Jordan. Now when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey and arose, went home to his house, to his city. He put his household in order, and he hanged himself and died and was buried in his father's tomb. That's the end of bitterness. That's the end of bitterness. You might just stop. I mean, those of us who've been adults for a while, sometimes you can wonder how many suicides result of bitterness. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? Makes you wonder. Here's a man who just would not forgive. He takes and he kills his life. And here is astounding, supernatural brilliance in a man, absolutely and completely destroyed by bitterness. The interesting thing is, in our service to the Lord, the fact of the matter is you and I are going to continually be bombarded with situations and things that will make us bitter if we're not careful about it. It's just the way that it is. Things are going to happen to us, situations that are going to be unfair, situations we're going to want to take into our own hands, all kinds of different things happening from the sources that you would never imagine. So it's not like Ahithophel is some distant kind of person that we can't relate to. It'll happen to all of us. All of us are going to be sinned against. But if you give place to bitterness and go his way, it'll be the death of God's call upon your life. And that's just your life. 20,000 men are going to follow this man. And then David went to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed over the Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. And Absalom made Amasa captain of the army instead of Joab. And this Amasa was the son of a man whose name was this, an Israelite who had gone into Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, Joab's mother. And so this Amasa is David's nephew. And so Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. And now it happened, when David had come to Mahanaim, that Shobi, the son of Nahash, from Rabbah of the people of Ammon, Machir, the son of Amiel from Lodabar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite from Rogalim, brought beds and basins, earthen vessels and wheat and barley and flour, parched grain and beans, lentils and parched seeds, honey and curds, sheep and cheese of the herd for David and the people who were with him to eat. For they said, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. And so David gets a little help from his friends, so to speak. Fascinating thing is, here's a group of three men who help David because it's the right thing to do. And they help David before they know what the end of this revolution is going to be. They have no idea whether Absalom is going to come on the scene with the army, destroy David, and then destroy them completely for having helped David out. And so what they're doing here, they do at enormous risk, not only to themselves, but to the lives of their families. But they do it because it's the right thing to do. And they help him out by giving him these supplies that they need. It was just the right thing to do. Chapter 18. And David numbered the people who were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. So Hushai has bought David a little bit of time now. Now they're, some of the men of Israel are realizing what's happening, and they're joining themselves to David. They're joining themselves against this rebellion. And so David's army is growing at this point in time. And then David sent out one-third of the people under the hand of Joab, and one-third under the hand of Abishai, Joab's brother, and one-third under the hand of Ittai, the Gittite. Yep. And the people, and the king said to the people, I also will surely go out with you myself. But the people answered and said, you shall not go out. For if we flee, they will not care about us. Nor if half of us die, will they care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us right now. For you are now more help to us in the city. David, don't go out into battle. If you get killed, we're going to be in deep trouble. You're the one that they're after. You stay in the city. And so the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. And so the king stood beside the gate, and all of the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. And so the king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And here is the heart of a father. I mean, it's pretty tough, isn't it? And he's having to put his people together to fight against this army and this rebellion that his son has led against him, and yet he can't win here. If he wins as a king, he loses as a father. If he wins as a father, he loses as a king. There's no way he can win here. And I think, again, there's that responsibility that David feels in his heart for his son and his place because of his failure in Absalom's life for in part for what's happened here. And so he asks, don't just deal gently with him, but notice those three words, for my sake. He sensed his own responsibility. For my sake, deal gently with him. And all of the people heard when the king gave all the captains orders concerning Absalom. And so the people went out into the field of battle against Israel, and the battle was in the woods of Ephraim. And the people of Israel were overthrown there before the servants of David, and a great slaughter of 20,000 men took place there that day. So 20,000 young men of Israel die in this battle of bitterness. For the battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. And then Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode on a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth. Here was this head of hair he was so proud of, and that weighed so many shekels at the end of a year, and now it's going to be his undoing. It gets caught in the tree. And so he was left hanging between heaven and earth. That's a bad place to be in a battle. And the mule, which was under him, went on. So that's a bad scene getting worse. Because now he's got the mule out from under him completely. So he's left hanging there now in a tremendous position of what? Vulnerability. And now what is he going to want? He's desperately going to want grace and mercy, but he's not going to get it. It's very real. So often we reap what we sow, and he's going to reap what he sowed. Not at the hand of David, but at the hand of Joab. When you treat someone wrongly, when you treat someone the way that Absalom treated David, you can almost bet your life on the fact that God will work things out in a way that you will need grace and mercy from the David that you once attacked in that way. I have seen it so many times in ministry. So many times. You have to be careful. The one that you rebel against, the one that you're going to try and destroy, the one that you're going to try and kill or kick while he's down and these kinds of things, it's never the end of the story. And the time, the whole thing ends up coming around full circle to where you will want from him the very thing you didn't give him. And so it's very, very good to do what then? Sow grace, sow mercy, sow love, in order that it can be reaped back into your life. And so he's hanging there, and a certain man saw it. You can't believe it. He comes around a bend, you can imagine, and there's Absalom hanging in the tree. Here is this great and giant rebellion against God's anointed. And how does it come to an end? Through a terebinth tree and a mule. Wasn't he kind of a big thing? Just a terebinth tree and a mule brings the whole thing to an end. And he said, I saw Absalom hanging in a terebinth tree. Joab said to the man who told him, you just saw him? And why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt. All right, Joab, man. It's 10 from the bottom, dialing for dollars. I'd have got 10 shekels and a belt? Seriously. Boy, what a terrible decision. The man said to Joab, though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand. Notice he didn't mention anything about the belt. Come on, Joab, a belt, seriously. 10,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise my hand against the king's son, for in our hearing the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom. Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely against my own life, for there is nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me. And Joab said, I can't linger here with you. You're making too much sense. And so he took 3 spears. This Joab, I don't know that we'll see him, but interesting. And so he took 3 spears in his hand, and he thrust them through Absalom's heart. And this guy was a man of war. He knew where the heart was. And while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree, and 10 young men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him, finished him off. And then Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab held back the people. In other words, there was a great slaughter, already 20,000 men dead on the side of Absalom. He realized he's killed the whole source of the rebellion. There's no sense in killing more people. He blows the trumpet and calls the army of David back to himself. And they took Absalom and cast him into a large pit in the woods and laid a very large heap of stones over him. And then all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up a pillar for himself, which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name. And to this day it is called Absalom's Monument. So he built a monument to himself, not having a son. He wanted people to remember him. And so he builds a monument. The best monument, the best thing we can ever do to get people to remember us when we're gone, if you're concerned about such things, is to be a man of godly character. He would have been remembered. He would have been perhaps a great king of Israel. But he decides he wants to be remembered by some kind of a memorial, some kind of a thing that he built physically. And then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, let me now run and take the news to the king, how the Lord has avenged him of his enemies. And Joab said to him, you shall not take the news this day, for you shall take the news another day. But today you shall take no news, because the king's son is dead. Ahimaaz, I don't want you to take Bad news to the king. You just chill, just wait here, and another day I'll use you to send news to the king. And then Joab said to the Cushite, Cushite was an Ethiopian, probably a slave, go tell the king what you've seen. And so the Cushite bowed himself to Joab, and he ran, and Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, which was one of the priests, again said to Joab, but whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite. And Joab said, why will you run, my son, since you have no news ready? But whatever happens, he said, Ahimaaz said, let me run. And so Joab said to him, run. And then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain, and he outran the Cushite. Now David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate to the wall, lifted up his eyes and looked, and there was a man running alone. And the watchman cried out and told the king, and the king said, if he's alone, there is news in his mouth. And he came rapidly and drew near. And then the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, there's another man running alone. And the king said, he also brings news. And so the watchman said, I think the running of the first is the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, he's a good man, and he comes with good news. So this guy was apparently known as a guy that only brought good news. And Ahimaaz called out and said to the king as he arrived before the Cushite, all is well. And then he bowed down with his face to the earth before the king and said, blessed be the Lord your God who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king. And the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? And Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant and me, your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was about. And the king said to him, turn aside and stand here. And so he turned aside and he stood still. Here's a guy that is eager to bring news to David. But when he comes face to face with David, and he realizes that David is eager not only to hear about how the battle went, but how it went with his son, he wilts before the responsibility of delivering bad news to the king. That's just the kind of guy he is. He's the kind of a guy that will only deliver good news, or he won't deliver it. He won't deliver bad news, just won't do it. And so he's got all of these advantages. He's a young man, he's a swift man, he's the son of a priest, and yet he wasn't willing to declare any message unless that message was popular news or it was positive news. And what does Jesus, what does David tell him here? David tells him, turn aside and stand here. You just stand over here by the side. And that's what he says to everyone who's called to carry a message but won't carry the full message, only wants to carry the popular stuff, only wants to carry what they call the positive stuff. They end up standing by the wayside, unused. And then comes a Cushite, a slave, a man without all of the background and all of the advantage of Ahimaaz. He's a simple man. He's probably an uneducated man. But he does one thing. He delivers the news, and he delivers it accurately. And that's exactly what was needed in that hour, and that's what's needed in this hour. And the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, there is good news, my lord the king. For the Lord has avenged you this day of all those who rose against you. And the king said to the Cushite, Is the young man Absalom safe? And the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you to do you harm be as that young man is. And then the king was deeply moved, and he went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said thus, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son. So five times, you know, if you've ever been hit with bad news, grievous news, again, your whole life is just, it's spinning inside your mind. And you just head into that repetition over what it is that's broken your heart. And now he's just saying, you know, almost involuntarily, you know, my son, my son, my son, my son. And And his heart is so broken as a father here over his son's death. And then Joab was told, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." And so the victory that day was turned into mourning for all of the people. For the king, people heard it said that day, "The king is grieved for his son." And the people stole back into the city that day as people who were ashamed steal back when they flee in battle. But the king covered his face, and the king cried out with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son." And so here David continues to grieve the death of his son Absalom. And David has lost perspective here because, again, he's not only a father, but he's a king. And it's important for him not only to represent his heart as a father, and he's doing that here, but he must also take into account the fact that he must properly represent God. And he must properly represent God as the king. And what he's doing now is all of these men who went out and they put their life on the line for David, coming back and being thanked and they're being gratefulness for what it is that they did. Now they see the king grieving over the great victory that God had given to them. And so it was like being defeated, only worse, because you won the victory and now, you know, the king makes you feel like you've done a terrible thing here. And so they're slinking around, and Joab has a sense for what it is that's going on here. And he rebukes David, and he counsels David in verse 5. And he came to the house of the king, and he said, "Today you've disgraced all of your servants who today have saved your life, and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, and the lives of your concubines, and that you love your enemies and you hate your friends. For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants, for today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of the rest of us had died, it would have pleased you well." And that was what was being communicated to David's army. So we have to be careful that the sorrows of this life don't overwhelm the responsibility of properly representing the Lord and God's call upon our lives. And Joab is speaking very, very firmly to David. And to David's credit, he's teachable. Even though he's the king, he's teachable and he receives the counsel. It's very important that in our grief and in the situations that are very grievous sometimes in the course of our lives, in the course of our ministries, that we don't allow that grief to move us away from our service to the Lord. And Joab's counsel is actually quite brilliant on another sense, in that he's not going to allow David to head into his shell. He's going to force David to continue to be the king. Get out there in front of the people. Keep on moving forward in your life. It's hard, it's difficult, and you're grieving over your son, but keep moving forward, keep being what you are, keep doing what God has called you to do, and he'll take care of these things. And now, therefore, verse 7, "Arise, go out and speak comfort to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, not one will stay with you this night, and it will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now." And then the king arose, and he sat on the gate, and they told all of the people, saying, "There is the king sitting in the gate." And so all of the people came before the king, for every one of Israel had fled to his tent. Now all of the people were in dispute throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king saved us from the hand of our enemies, and he delivered us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled from the land because of Absalom. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now, therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king?" And so nothing has worked out the way that the people that led the rebellion against David thought it would work out. And so now they ask themselves, what in the world do we do with David? What do we do now? And so it says that then in verse 11, "Then King David went to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, saying, speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the words of all Israel have come to the king, even to his house? You are my brethren. See, he was of the tribe of Judah. And you are my bone and my flesh. Why then are you the last to bring back the king? And it's because they were ashamed. They had joined a rebellion against their own flesh and blood. And say to Amasa, why are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab. And so he swayed the hearts of all of the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man, and so that they sent this word to the king, return you and your servants. And then the king returned and came to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king, to escort the king across the Jordan. And so David now is a very, very gracious man. He's a very broken man at this time in his life. And the men of Judah, they just wanted a peace pipe. They just wanted a gesture on David's part that if he returned back to being the king, that he wouldn't slaughter him. And so David is very gracious. You rebelled against me. You joined in that rebellion. But if you let me come back, and I'm allowed to come back, I'm not going to, you know, take it out on you. And it would have been another blood fest if they hadn't let him, because the rest of the tribes were wanting him back. And so David returned and he came to the Jordan, verse 15, and Judah came to meet him there and they escorted him across the Jordan. And Shimei, oh yes, our dear friend Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, hastened and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons, and his 20 servants with him. And they went over the Jordan before the king. And then a ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. Now Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan, and he said to the king, you're going to laugh. Don't let the king impute iniquity to me, or remember, you know, what wrong your servant did on the day that my lord, the king, left Jerusalem. Oh, it's a different, this is a new man. He's got religion. That the king should take it to heart. Listen, I mean, you didn't take seriously all that throwing dirt and stones and cursing and the things that I was saying, did you? Oh, listen, you have to know me. It's a dry sense of humor that I have, David. I mean, come on. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. And therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all of the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord, the king. But Abishai, the son answered and said, shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the king's anointed? And then David said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zerai? What do I, that you should be adversaries to me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? For do I not know that today I am king over Israel? Do I have to kill this guy to feel like I'm the king? Or to feel that I'm in charge or I'm in control? And therefore the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king swore to him. And so here is Shimei, and here's not quite the end of the story, because we'll see him a little bit later, and he makes a tremendous blunder a little bit later. He's a man given to these kinds of things, apparently. But he learns a lesson that we need to learn, and that is, don't kick a man when he's down. Because you don't know how long he'll be down. And you don't know what the rest of the story is, and you don't know what God is going to do through that man. And again, I will say, and I'm not the old wise owl in the body of Christ, but I have seen it continually over and over and over and over again, where someone is down, and oftentimes down for purposes that only God is aware of. And then they are spat upon, and they are kicked, and they are ill-treated, and all of these things. And then to everyone's surprise, this God of ours, who is so involved in producing resurrection, ends up resurrecting that person, and then these others are in the place of Shimei. And now he wants from David what he had an opportunity to give to David and did not, and that is grace. You will never lose. I will never lose by extending grace to people in their time of need. Someday, we're going to need grace, and oftentimes we're going to need grace from the very people that we think are never going to rise again. And David doesn't repay evil for evil here. He is a man of greater character than Shimei, and he goes on about his business, and he ignores the counsel to take vengeance against Shimei. Now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. And this is the descendant of Saul that Ziba had said, no, he thinks that he's going to join with Absalom and the kingdom's going to be restored to him. And this was the man that was lame in both of his feet, so he couldn't get around except for a donkey. And so he came down to meet the king, and he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes, didn't trim his toenails or anything like that, from the day the king departed until the day that he came back in peace. And all of that was a sign of mourning. And now all of a sudden it becomes apparent that Ziba was lying about this guy. Because if Absalom came upon Mephibosheth in that condition and saw him not eating, not drinking, not tending to himself, but engaged in these outward signs of mourning, he would know immediately that Mephibosheth's heart is still linked to David. So David now here has irrefutable proof that Mephibosheth was had not rebelled against him and that Ziba had really slandered him. And so it was when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? And he answered, my lord, O king, my servant Ziba, he deceived me. For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go to the king, because your servant is lame. And he has slandered your servant to the Lord my king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God, and therefore do what is good in your eyes. For all of my father's house were but dead men before you, before my lord the king. And yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table, and therefore what right have I still to cry out any more to the Lord? And so the king said to him, why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said, you and Ziba divide the land. And then Mephibosheth said to the king, rather let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house. Mephibosheth says, I don't care about the property. I don't care about any of those things. I just care about the fact that you are back. And then Barzillai, the Gileadite, came down from Roglem and went across the Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan. This was one of the three men that helped David when he needed that help in supplying him with food and all. Now, this man was a very aged man, 80 years old, and that was very old for those days. And he had provided the king with supplies while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very rich man. He used his riches to help David when David desperately needed help. And the king said to him, come across with me, and I'll provide for you while you are with me in Jerusalem. This is a tremendous offer that David is making to this man. David has enormous wealth, enormous power. He's returning to this kingdom. And he says, listen, I'll set you up for the rest of your life. And Barzillai said to the king, how long do I have to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I'm 80 years old today. Can I discern between the good and the bad? Can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? If you put good wine in front of me or bad wine, I won't be able to tell. If you put good food in front of me or bad food in front of me, my taste buds are shot. I'm not going to be able to tell. And he says, can I hear any longer the voice of singing men and singing women? All the things that you offer me, I can't appreciate. I don't have the capacity to appreciate those things anymore. And then why then should your servant be a burden, a further burden to my lord the king? Your servant will go a little ways across the Jordan with the king, and why should the king repay me with such a reward? Listen, David, you don't have to repay me for doing the right thing in that situation. Please let your servant turn back again, that I may die in my own city and be buried by the grave of my father and my mother. This is just, David, I appreciate the offer, but I want to die in my hometown, and I want to die with my family. But here's an older man who has a concern for the generations that are behind him, a generation for the younger people behind him. And he says, but here is your servant Chimham, which is probably a son or a grandson of this man. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what seems good to you. Desire to bless the younger generation. And the king answered, Chimham shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what seems good to you. Now whatever you request of me, I will do for you. And then all of the people went over the Jordan, and when the king had crossed over, the king kissed him and blessed him, and he returned to his own place. Now the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him, and all of the people of Judah escorted the king, and also half the people of Israel. And just then all of the men of Israel came to the king, and they said to the king, why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king, his household, and all David's men with him across the Jordan? Hey, wait a second. You never invited us to the parade. What's going on here? Oh, boy, a little petty, isn't it? That's the way it is sometimes. Hold on, wait a second. Am I the, you know, vice president, or am I the vice president? And so all of the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is a close relative of ours. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we ever eaten at the king's expense, or has he ever given us a gift? Listen, don't think that we're doing this to get something from David, and don't think that David is allowing us to take him across the river because he's going to do something special for us as the tribe of Judah just because we are of his tribe. And so, interesting, isn't it? Because this is a reflection of David's character as the king. He didn't extend pork to his district. And he had the opportunity to really, man, take and lavish the tribe of Judah because he had come from that tribe, but he didn't. He was fair with all of the tribes. And it was a testimony. The men of Judah could tell the men of the other tribes and say, listen, David's never done that, and he's not doing it to us now. And the men of Judah answered men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 shares in the king. There are 10 tribes. And therefore, we also have more right to David than you. Yeah, I know he came from your tribe, but we outnumber you 10-2. And why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to advise bringing back our king? Wasn't it our idea first? Oh, yeah? Oh, I want to bet? Well, no, he's my dad. No, he's my uncle. No, he's my... Oh, yeah. You know, that's what they're doing right here. Outside right now, buddy. They're just about to go to war over it. And yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. Can you imagine what God has to deal with on a daily basis as it relates to our lives? He saves all their lives. He restores the kingdom to them. I mean, he's been as gracious as can be. And these people can't see anything to be thankful for. The whole deal. It just, you know, prone to sin, wanting to fight with one another.